My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I'm with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I want to welcome you and introduce our first two speakers that are going to talk about the Atlas PAC Superfund site. First is Elaine Stanley, who is an environmental engineer with EPA for 18 years. She's worked in the RCRA program for 4 years prior to becoming a remedial project manager in 1994. She's worked on several surplus sites, most being fund-led in the RDRA phase of cleanup, including Atlas PAC Corporation Superfund site. For 4 years, she was involved in the liability and cost recovery litigation against the Atlas PAC site QRPs. Two settlements were reached in 2003 and 2006 with the settlement money financing part of the cleanup. Elaine has a BS in biology and a BS in civil engineering from the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and Amherst, respectively. And prior to EPA, she worked in a private practice.
Yes, she did. She got to.
With the presentation, too, I sent it. I emailed it.
Oh, great.
Just a reminder, if you are not a speaker, we need those phone lines muted. Use your own mute button or press *6 because we are hearing some dialogue right now. Thank you.
And the second speaker for the same presentation will be Ken Finkelstein, who works with NOAA. And he's been there since 1987, and he works to identify, evaluate, and both mitigate and restore the adverse effects of hazardous substances on marine and coastal resources and their supporting ecosystems. He has significant involvement with responsible parties and other government agencies leading to site cleanup and habitat restoration. His education includes a BS, MS, and PhD from Marine Science College of William & Mary, the Virginia School of Marine Sciences. And Ken is also a professor where he teaches environmental science and coastal geology at Suffolk University in Boston, Mass. So at this point, I'd like to start the presentation with Elaine and Ken, turning it over to you.
Thank you very much, Michelle. This is Elaine Stanley. My role in this will be to basically give you the site background, and then Ken will give the presentation talking about what we've done in the freshwater and saltwater marsh areas. We're looking at A1, the slide A1 now. That's a photo of the southern piece of the marsh looking out into Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts, in southeast Massachusetts. We can go to the next slide, A2. And this is an aerial photograph taken approximately 1978. And what we see here is it's the entire site is approximately 48 acres of salt marsh below the hurricane dike, which extends from west to east, which is about the center of the picture. As you can see, and then there's the facility to the northwest, big building, which is where they made Atlas PAC Corporation made tacks, rivets, bolts, and the like. Now we in Buzzard Bay is directly south, with Boys Creek running through the hurricane dike that you can see. So that's just a nice picture of the site itself. Slide A3. The Atlas PAC Corporation operated from 1901 to 1985. They basically were the sole providers of people in the town of Fairhaven in Massachusetts. The waste that were generated at the facility included electroplating. They did a lot of electroplating, acid washing, annealing, painting, and these wastes were discharged outside. Turning to A4, starting about 1940, wastewater was discharged into the floor drains. There was a big trench running down the middle of the facility into an on-site lagoon, and then from the lagoon, spilling out with an outlet into the marsh itself. There was also all of their solid and liquid waste were disposed of on site in the rear of the facility, filling in a good portion of the wetland. Slide A5. The contaminants of concern, obviously, are we've got metals, arsenic, cadmium, zinc, antimony, and lead, and actually copper. Copper, nickel, and zinc are our predominant metals of concern at the site. Of course, cyanide from hydraulic oils, SVOCs, mainly polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, VOCs used for solvent use, and pesticides, which were likely present because of the town, spraying back in the 60s to keep the mosquitoes at bay. Okay, slide A6. This is a picture of the areas of cleanup. We divided the site up into three areas because they were basically unique. The red area is the what we call the commercial area, and that's where the facility is located along with a power plant and a smokestack. And inside the building, there's a plating pit, a pickling trench, this long trench that collected all the waste. The blue area is called the solid waste and debris area, and that's where they basically filled in the wetland. And as you can see, the green area, you can see that it's essentially been filled in because the blue is filling it in, and that's where your marsh is. It was called Boys Creek Marsh, and the hurricane dike in the bottom right-hand corner runs through where there's a 48-inch culvert where Boys Creek runs through it. Now, there's another marsh just to the east of this marsh. It's called Girls Creek, and that's pretty pristine. We've used that as background comparison. So moving on to slide A7. We broke the cleanup into three phases. Phase one being the first area, which is about a 10-acre area. In 2005, we demolished the one-story building, which was a sawtooth building, and there was a rear three-story building, power plant, a couple of smaller sheds, and a 180-foot smokestack. We then removed the plating pit, the pickling trench, the waste conveyance systems, and any adjacent soils, and was disposed off-site. All material in the remedy was deemed to be disposed of off-site. We excavated about almost 800 cubic yards of soil and mostly plating sludge from that pit. It was a pretty huge pit, like 50 by 60. The total cost was about $2.3 million. We started in September 2005 and actually completed most of it that fall, but wrapped it up the next fall. Slide A8. These are just some pictures of the three-story building and the power plant that were taken down. There was actually asbestos in the actual window caulking. There was asbestos paint in the boiler room. So we had a number of other types of things to do prior to demolishing the buildings. A9, the solid waste and debris area, was actually the largest amount of waste that we were to remove. It's approximately 9 acres, we estimated about 38,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil and debris, and a lot of tacks were in there, and you could see that areas wouldn't even grow. And that was completed in this past April 2007, and the cost was approximately $14 million. We are having the Army Corps of Engineers is our construction manager, and we have Roy F. Weston and Charter Environmental doing the actual work. Slide A10, this is just a photograph of the solid waste and debris area prior to remediation, and as you can see, there's just essentially no growth. A11, third phase is the marsh area, both north and south of the hurricane dike. And that was estimated to cost about $5 million. That piece has actually gone up. We ended up taking out about 34,000 cubic yards in the solid waste and debris area. We are at a point now where we are actually planting. We've done all of our excavation except for one small spot, and we actually ended up excavating. It's going to turn out to be closer to 30,000 cubic yards removed from the marsh soil and the creek bed sediment as well. Okay. This is a photograph of the hurricane dike, and it actually, you're looking from the bottom of the page to the top of the page is north to south. So as the creek gets bigger, you're heading south toward the Priest Cove or part of Buzzards Bay. This is prior to excavation, and we do have some great photographs that show actually the lagoon and the migration of contaminant that you can see from the air, but we don't have them here in this presentation. Okay, slide A13. So phase three, we're on schedule. We will have a construction complete in September, and the restoration work began in May, and it's really coming along nicely. And after, we also have groundwater monitoring situation is the remedy for the stormwater. It's slightly contaminated, and we have actual ecological interim cleanup levels. This was essentially a 95% ecological cleanup. We did have some human risk in the commercial area and also shellfish. However, this was essentially an environmental and ecological cleanup. Okay, 10. I think maybe...
No, we've got a few more.
We have a few more. Okay.
Yeah, just a few slides showing the north, south, and north.
Okay, this is actually the south side of the hurricane dike. And as you can see, there's a lot of phragmite growth. It's probably goes in about 30 feet to the dike. But we have some nice alterna fauna. And
Cystica spicata.
Cystica spicata.
The
risk... site basically with movement of contamination to groundwater, surface water, the creek sediment from the contaminated areas, exposure of biota to contaminated soil and sediment from these contaminated areas, into the surface water and into the sediment of Boys Creek. A17, the funding. Essentially the funding, phase one was $2.3 million. We got a part of it was from a settlement, one of the PRPs, $500,000. DEP fronted $750,000 of their 10% share, and then we ended up getting $1 million from headquarters. Because we were waiting for funding, it took us about 3 years to actually get some funding to go through the priority panel. Phase two is approximately 14,000, and phase three is looking more like 6.5. So we're looking closer to like $22 million as a total cleanup cost. Total O&M and LTRA costs are going to be approximately $800,000. And essentially, from what the ROD estimate was and cost of inflation, we are about right on target as to what the estimated cost of the remedy was going to be. So that was pretty good. I didn't write the ROD, but whoever did do that did a good job. And we've received approximately, actually at this point, $1.5 million from Atlas Tac Corporation. So we've received about $2 million. We'll receive about another million. So we're barely getting, a little more than 10% of the PRP. So we've already started groundwater monitoring. We're putting in new wells because we had some wells in the wetland, and they were destroyed because they were overburdened wells, pretty shallow. It was estimated that it would take about 10 years to clean up the groundwater. And we were going to do phytoremediation, but decided against it, and Ken will explain why when we talk about the freshwater wetland. We need as much water coming in to the wetland as possible. And obviously we're going to be monitoring the wetland as we go. So Ken, I'm going to turn it over to you when you can talk about that, what we do.
Okay, this is starting on A19, extensive marsh cleanup based on the results from the pre-remedial design study, what we've also called the bioavailability study, and I'll get into that in a minute. This, again, is going to be really phase three. Everything from now on is really focusing on phase three of the cleanup. And I do want to point out that there was involvement from others outside of EPA and NOAA. The Army Corps of Engineers was quite helpful in providing advice on some of the ecological revitalization we'll be showing you in a minute. And Western Solutions was an excellent contractor who we worked with, who was pretty forthcoming and helpful throughout the process. So if we go to I should really point out also when you look at it, when we say bioavailability study, what we mean here is that when the ROD was written in the year 2000, we had some sediment cleanup numbers, but if we used those sediment cleanup numbers, we would have had to remove the entire salt marsh. And we became very reluctant to do so because it looks like a functional salt marsh. And so we went back and did a second study looking at the sediment triad method, toxic testing, benthic community analysis, and sediment chemistry to come up with a new cleanup number for the salt marsh and freshwater marsh behind the dike. Now, for the A20, you get another view of the site. Again, that dike that runs right through the middle of it is really instrumental to the thing that we're going to be doing because it's that has so much of our troubles. That is, it's a small creek coming through the dike, and only a limited amount of water can get behind it, which results in, first of all, the contaminants backing up behind it, and second of all, a great growth of phragmites back there because not enough salt water can get through the culvert during the six-hour tide as the water comes in and goes out. So that is a real problem for us, and we'll get into how we redesign that in a minute. If you look at these, though, you'll see all sorts of numbers. And when we did the bioavailability study and we looked at the toxicity testing and the sediment chemistry, we decided rather than looking at single chemical components, look at what we call the ERMQ, or the effects range median number quotient. That is, we took all of the six metals, which were the six principal problems, and we had then come up with a concentration of each divided by their respective screening number, which is the effects range median, and then divided that number by six to come up with a value, and then matched that up against the toxicity testing that we had to come up with a new cleanup number for the salt and freshwater marshes. The number, fortuitously, or it just happens to come up just about at 1.0. And so what you're looking at here are those locations where we saw concentrations above 1 ERMQ. And that's the area that would need to be cleaned up, and that's what you see in red on figure 820. Of course, later we went back and did quite a bit more sampling to come up with a better idea of how much we would need to clean up. So we go to 821. You see it again a little bit from a different view to give you an idea of the whole site. The site, again, the Atlas Tac Corporation is in the upper left, the dike running through, and these are all the concentrations we saw during the bioavailability study. A22, marsh, really shouldn't say marsh remediation, but we see a salt marsh here, Boys Creek running through, a lot of high marsh vegetation, a lot of Disticula spicata. For those of you who are into the vegetation types, there is some alternophora as well, especially hugging Boys Creek. It's not really well shown on this map. A23 gives you another view showing you the seven salt marsh, showing you how it in its glory in the summertime, which was one of our reasons why we were a little reluctant to remove everything, which is what the original ROD would have had us do. And A24, again, this is a similar figure from before, gives you a nice view of how narrow that culvert is and how much phragmites, which is the tanna color or the color or the material or the vegetation that hugs the dike in the upper left and all along the on the south side or in the foreground around the dike. It's north at the top and south is bottom, and of course the flow is going towards the Buzzards Bay. A25, this is what we came up with the final sampling, and this is what needed to be removed. It says south of barrier, revised limit of excavation. On the north side, which I'm going to get to secondly, we had to remove pretty much everything, about 4.5 acres up there. Down here is about 1.5 acres that needed to be removed where we saw concentrations above 1 on the ERMQ cleanup number. And you'll see most of the areas about 0 to 1 feet, some areas are 0 to 2 feet. There is going to be some phragmites that are going to be removed as well. And which when we started thinking about it, why would we want to backfill with the same elevations that we already had? So the nice thing about being able to revitalize the phragmites is that we just will not backfill that area. And we're back to quite a bit, lowering the profile, allowing more salt water to come in, and getting rid of some of the phragmites that are on the fringe of this area. If you go to A26, you see some of this work going on. Now, this is really pretty simple stuff, and nothing really very new going on here, pretty much digging up some of the salt marsh and just pretty much lowering the profile so that the phragmites will not invade the area. Or as we take out a little bit of the phragmites as well. And you see in A26 work going on. And then if we move on to A27, you see it again. This was probably our largest area. You'll see again some phragmites and some to the right and in the background as well. And here it looks in more recently with the removal just about complete. You see them in the background just pretty much doing the finishing touches. And we have this pretty much blank area in the middle of the salt marsh, and that is going to be revegetated. A29 shows you where the plants are. We originally were planning to seed the area, but found that we couldn't find enough seed, and so actually went out and got some of the Distichia spicata to actually plant there, and that will be starting very, very shortly. This is one of the reasons why the cost went up a little bit. Elaine could probably tell me how much, but I try not to ask her how much more went up, because we, rather than seeding it, we're putting the plants in. And here we see some of the work that was done around the channel, some of the core logs, which you can just kind of make out in the next slide. And this is A30, I'm sorry. In the next slide, A30, I want to show you the core logs a little more close up, because we had to do quite a bit of removal on the bank of the channel, which meant we're actually rebuilding the channel itself. And A31 shows you the core log that's being put in place, and behind it will be backfilled to try to bring up the profile a little bit to even with the salt marsh and rebuild the channel bank. A32, we're going to be moving up to the north side of the dike, and this is where things got a little bit more interesting. The bottom, the south side is pretty standard stuff. The north side, things were a little bit more tricky, because again we had that problem of getting enough water back behind the dike. Now, quite easily it could have been, you know, if we wanted to get salt water back there, probably the easiest way of doing this would be just to open the culvert up more. This culvert can be blocked up during a hurricane. It's a hurricane dike. But the problem is that you really can't do this under CERCLA funding. We can't just basically redesign a wetland, because we like the idea of having a salt marsh and getting rid of the phragmites. So we could not do anything with the culvert itself that went through the hurricane dike. Rather, and also it was several $1 million to do. And although it doesn't sound like it should cost that much, that's what we were told it would cost. So rather than doing that, We redesigned the wetlands in the north part of the dike. And let me go to 833. Some of the work starting to get done. We put a remediation control berm here to try to block off the areas that are going to be excavated. Because again, if you remember from early on when I showed you the ERMQ map, the area was completely red. All the wetlands up here are going to be removed. So if you're going to remove the wetlands, you have now an opportunity to revitalize the wetland, in which case we removed the phragmites, lowered the profile, and are going to rebuild a whole new fresh and saltwater wetland. Again, you can't get enough saltwater back there, but we do have quite a bit of fresh water in the groundwater that if we block off and build a dike, we can actually create both a freshwater wetland and a saltwater wetland back there. Go to A34, showing you this was the remediation berm, showing you the time when removal is going on. What I learned, one of the things is that I thought the winter, and we had some pretty horrendously cold days up here in New England, actually made it easier to remove the wetland material. They found that the frozen soils were actually easier to remove than if it was wet. A35 shows you again in the wintertime, pumping the water out of the northern wetlands down to on the other side of the hurricane dike, pretty much standing on the hurricane dike, and the water is being pumped on the other side of it. You can see the town of Fairhaven in the distance, and to the upper left is where the facility used to be, the buildings used to be that have now been removed.
Ken,
yes.
This is Jean. I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. If anyone's having problems following along with the images, you can use the icon at the top of your screen. It looks like a small computer disk. You can use that to actually download the PowerPoint files as either PDF or Microsoft PowerPoint files locally, and you can click through the materials that way rather than moving through the slides online. Thanks.
Okay, so we're up to figure A36, and this is when some of the remediation really got started in September 06, and this is in the area that is now, you can see the sediments being removed, excavated contaminant fill soils are now being dug out, exposing the native glacial outwash, and so this material started to go out in about September 2006, A37. Shows you what finally I want to get to, and you know, all of what I've talked about can all be pretty much summed up in this slide right here in the restoration plan. But I wanted to give you a feel for what the site looked like. So again, if you look at the restoration plan and you look at the map, you'll see what the northern wetlands will eventually look like. We have Boys Creek that runs through the culvert, and of course it runs from top to bottom, and now we're no longer dealing with the southern area where we've pretty much discussed that already. And now we're in the northern area, and a new berm is going to be developed to create a freshwater wetland, which will be on the left side or the lower left side of the northern area, with the saltwater marsh on the right side of the berm. There's enough saltwater that gets in to allow for a saltwater marsh to occur in a relatively small area. The phragmites won't infringe upon it because there's enough saltwater there. And we're going to be building a new freshwater wetland with a man-made berm with some spillways allowing the water to get over. Most of the water, or fresh water, is from groundwater, some storm water, I believe, as well. And there are going to be some islands built in there for more deciduous type vegetation. And eventually we will also do have a criteria to make sure that we have some phragmites control. So if the phragmites does try to infringe upon it, we will be spraying before that should take place. A38 gives you another view for the engineers, a little bit more detail. Elaine made me show you this because she's an engineer. But you can kind of see the... you want to say anything? No? Okay. You can see the way the berm is developed around the freshwater wetland. It says berm slope up and... this is just something to kind of take a look at for those of you who really want to get into the detail of it. The high marsh will be following Boys Creek, a relatively small one, but nevertheless it should be functional and should not allow any phragmites control.
Yeah, I'd like to just add one thing here. I had mentioned that we had prior remediation as part of the remedy, and it was to lower the groundwater table so that groundwater would not flow through residual contamination through the commercial area from east to west. Now, we basically said, no, we can't do that because now we need as much groundwater as possible flowing into the freshwater wetland because we determined that we weren't getting as much flow as we wanted to. We also found that there was some glacial till that we had to actually bore through and basically run a trench to help bring the water into the freshwater wetland itself. Okay. Thanks.
A39 shows you some of the work that's just recently been done. This is from June of this year. Showing you some of the salt marsh vegetation planted in the northern area in the salt water zone. And I really want you to take a very look closely at this slide because you can see the larger berm in the distance just in front of the tractor. That is going to separate the mainland from the freshwater marsh. And then there is some mounds, and just behind those mounds, you'll see a small dike. I believe this was taken in June, and you can see a small dike, and that's going to separate the saltwater marsh from the freshwater marsh. So you have the mainland dike, and then the salt freshwater dike, and those are all being developed. But what I wanted to point out here is also some of the vegetation that's now being planted for the salt marsh itself. A30 shows you now the dike, the berm, I should really say, being more created, some of the islands being done behind it. Again, in the background, that's going to be the salt marsh. In the foreground, that's going to be the fresh marsh. And you see one of the islands being developed, and that was taken just recently. A41 shows you a close-up of one of the little islands. A42 shows you some of the redevelopment and reconstruction of Boys Creek Channel just north of the Hurricane Dike. A43 shows some of the erosion control blankets a little bit further to the north on Boys Creek to keep the channel in place. A44 gives you an overview of the entire site. Again, you can see just barely a little bit of the growth that the planting that's been done for the salt marsh area. Boys Creek runs right, left to right. There's another creek that enters that already has its erosion control blanket already in. But what you see in the foreground, that's not Boys Creek. It runs into Boys Creek, which you'll see sort of mid on the left. A45 gives you a little chronology of what's been going on in June, some of the upland work, the transition area, some of the vegetation being done there. And the bottom right shows you the northwest tributary, which is what I was showing you before, with some of the seeding that's been going on. So this is the process that we've been going through, trying to revitalize what was once a very poor salt marsh and Phragmites wetland after removal, being able to do this using CERCLA funding. A46, again, a little bit more. The slide I showed you, the upper ledge shows you the vegetation. And the upper right, the Boys Creek seeded and stabilized with the erosion control blankets. And then, of course, the two below shows you some of the vegetation going on. All these last few slides is everything that's going on in the north. The southern side is pretty much more, as I said before, routine type of removal and mitigation. One of the things I wanted to point out, some of the propaganda part about my talk is what NOAA can do for you, because we have an IAG with EPA. We've had it for many years, and we provide technical assistance to EPA. So a lot of the work that I've been showing you was stuff that NOAA has helped EPA on at no cost. I mean, we already have the IAG. In a sense, you have a restoration consultant sitting in your offices. And one of the things that we can help provide is the fifth one down, technical assistance on feasibility design and construction details. And that's some of the stuff that we did. Now, not necessarily only myself, but I brought a couple of people and one person in particular to help with some of the restoration work. And his name is Jim Turek, and he's with our restoration center. A48 some of the things that we do, both with EPA, the very first bullet, working with EPA and DOD on design assistance on remedial sites to combine remediation and restoration. That's exactly what went on here. Although you might call it mitigation, restoration, I mean, those words are often taken over by people, but usually EPA does mitigation and trustees do restoration, but really it's the same thing. A49 gives you some of the things that our restoration center can do and has done in the past. And give you an example, on A50, one of the things that we helped with was come up with the warm season grass mix. Personally, I did not know this. I needed to bring somebody else in, and he was able to come up with where to get the seeds, or what type of seeds we should use. And this is information that NOAA can provide without any cost at all. And A51, final shot, blue heron sitting out in the salt marsh in the winter scene. And I think we're all done, and take some questions if you'd like.
Okay, thanks, Ken and Elaine. I see that we have a couple of questions that folks have typed in. Ken, Elaine, do you want to read the questions, or do you prefer that I do that?
I can read.
Okay. So I suggest that we answer those questions first, and then we can open up the phone lines for folks who just want to ask questions directly to you.
Sure. Mike Hurd, hi, Mike, from headquarters, has asked a question. If required, who will be responsible for the long-term maintenance of the newly constructed wetland marsh area? The way this goes at a fund lead site, the first year after the construction complete date, which we are assuming is going to be September 30th, at 11:59. No, I'm kidding. It's going to be the end of September. And when DEP and EPA concur that the construction has been completed according to all specifications, et cetera, then we, a year, whichever is earliest, EPA is responsible for the operation and maintenance of the wetland. When it becomes sort of operational and functional, like I said, it's up to a year from this construction complete date. The state of Massachusetts will then take over operation and maintenance and monitoring of the all of the areas except for the groundwater monitoring. That will stay with EPA for another 10 years. Which we, EPA, will be doing. The state will share the 10% cost with us on that. However, the state will be financially responsible for the operation and maintenance for the rest of the site.
Okay. And his next question, what does IAG stand for? From Janice Wiggins from ADEC in Fairbanks. Well, the short answer is that it stands for Interagency Agreement, but I usually don't have trouble with short answers. I need to go back to 1980 when CERCLA was ratified. It says in there that EPA must notify, actually it says the lead agency must notify and coordinate with the Natural Resource Trustees, which is what NOAA is. Unfortunately, it was an unfunded mandate. No, there was no superfund for the trustees, for NOAA, for instance. And so what EPA did was that they provided us the funding so that we could do our jobs in looking at after natural resource injuries. But the deal was that we would provide EPA technical support, and that's what I spend most of my time with, both looking after injuries and potentially looking at the opportunities for natural resource damage assessments, but generally most of my time spent working with EPA providing technical assistance. Unfortunately, we'll pass on that. Our funding is being cut, but that's my own – sorry? That's my own belly aching anyway, but that's what it stands for, we have a NOAA liaison in each of the coastal EPA regions. For Alaska, that person would sit in the Seattle office.
This is Carl from Fox Ridge. What was the initial die-off rate of your vegetation before you had to revegetate?
Could you repeat that, sir?
I was wondering what the initial die-off rate of your revegetation was. Was it about a third that you had to revegetate after you did the initial planting?
The die-off in the
you did the initial planting. Did some of them, not all of them, lived, right?
We are just doing the initial planting now.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're going to have about a 3-year survival rate, or?
Yeah, we're going to be looking, absolutely. I mean, we've got a restoration plan that specifically calls out for what to do and what to expect and how we would deal with it. But it, certainly in the first 5 years, it's going to be rather intensive monitoring and maintenance.
Do you have any problems controlling invasive species?
Yes, of course. Phragmites is the biggest one. And what we're trying to do is we slope the freshwater wetland so that it can't grow there. And the saltwater areas, we're actually going to be removing them and then doing some wipe herbicide application to see how that works.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ken and Lane, this is Michelle. I see there's a few more questions that folks have written in. Do you see those on your screen?
Yes, we do.
What type of stormwater?
The type of stormwater management quality and quality control was designed at man-made berm around the freshwater wetland. What we do have is we actually have a couple of spillways on top of the berm should we have overflow of the, we're thinking freshwater, the saltwater, and that's our main control there. If we do have, a severe storm, I've seen it, the place completely flooded. So we've tried to make the height of the berm, the highest point, a certain amount of feet higher than the highest point of high tide, that we see at the highest point in a year. And I think we may have looked also at a storm event, in determining the height. Other than that, we basically that's what our storm control is, essentially. Does that answer your question?
Is that typing?
Okay. The latest date of the freshwater planting will be middle of August. So we have another couple of weeks, and we should be done with the planting. As far as the construction timeline available for freshwater projects, the best time, I believe, to plant is in June and September. Since we needed a completion date in September, the contractor, what he did was he said, okay, I'll take my chances and plant. And so they've done the planting, and they're really heavily watering the areas so that they won't lose the plants.
Another question was, have you looked for contamination in the offshore sediments, and if so, is there a need for remediation? We did this as part of the remedial investigation back in the early mid-90s. It was quite a long time ago. And the contamination really dropped off considerably once we got outside into Buzzards Bay, so it never really got off the ground, anything off there, and everything was focused on the wetlands.
Ken, there was another question that came in regarding funding.
Is there funding for long-term monitoring / adaptive management for the marsh, i.e. independent of contaminant issues? No, not that we are aware of. The funding is going to come from EPA the first year and the state of Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection from here on in. There's really no end date for O&M, so that's where the funding is coming from. However, there is an interested party, at least in part of the marsh, that somebody may take it over as conservation land and may take that over, but that's in the future. We have not really gone down that road yet, but there potentially could be some interested parties in doing some management.
Okay, we'd like to open up the phone lines now for questions. If anyone has something for the speakers, you can unmute your phone lines by pressing #6, and feel free to speak up and open up and ask a question.
Hi, this is Tom Schneider, and I was wondering if you could clarify the role of CERCLA versus NRDA at the site. Is there an NRDA case involved, and was there a settlement associated with it, or has it all been done with fund money and not NRDA suit money?
None of the funding here has any NRD contribution at all. There was no NRD settlement with the major responsible party. There was a small settlement that DOI had with a smaller party, but this is all using CERCLA funding. Everything you see, everything we did was based on the CERCLA.
Okay, thanks. That's what I thought, but somewhere along the line got the impression that NRDA was involved. Thanks.
Again, feel free to unmute your phone line and ask a question. You can do that by pressing #6.
Yes, I have a question. Where did you take the material that you removed, and how much did it cost per square yard?
Okay. The amount of material that was removed totaled approximately 65,000 cubic yards of material. We disposed probably 90% of that were soils that could go to non-hazardous landfills, some municipal landfills even, or some what they call COM 97, which is a state term for sort of like industrial type contaminated soils, with basically elevated metals, cyanide and PAHs. And there was the only thing that really had to go to a hazardous waste facility was the flooding sludge, and that went up to Stabler up in Quebec. So it varied. Obviously, the cost varies. We went to a municipal landfill. You know, you're talking about $15 a ton, and then if you go to a Subtitle D facility where you had to go to a lined landfill, even though it wasn't considered RCRA hazardous, that could take you up as much as $50 a ton. The hazardous waste, I believe, was up in the order of, $400 a ton.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Again, any last remaining questions for our speakers?
That actually was the expensive part of the whole project was the transportation and disposal of the contaminated material.
I have a question. Were there any issues or questions raised in the course of this project about the value of the remedial action taken? And if so, I was wondering how were those questions answered, whether there was any structured valuation exercise taken at any point of any kind that was used.
You mean if thinking that this new wetland had some value to it, it would balance some of the costs?
Yeah. And whether some sort of analysis was done to respond to those kinds of questions. And just curious, was there any attempt to monetize things or responses regarding valuation in other terms?
The short answer is no, it wasn't done. No.
What the record of decision did say, however, was that we were to bring the original contour of the wetland back to where it was prior to the manufactured operations getting online. So that would be pre-1901 contours, which is what we did.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. Did you use any field-based tools and dynamic work plans to segregate the different types of sediment? It looks like you had a pretty sharp from $15 to $50 to $400 per ton. So did you dynamically segregate those on site, or did you delineate the excavation areas and move forward from there?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. Yes, we did. We delineated the entire site with grids, 125 by 125 foot grids. And then what we would do is we would excavate, and seriously, by each soil pile, truckload, we identified exactly where it was in a particular grid, J1, H2, that type of thing. So we used GPS to survey the locations. So we knew exactly where every pile came from. We would do our characterization sampling and know exactly where it came from. And our confirmation sampling was also GPS surveyed. And so we kept incredibly good track on where everything came from and the types of waste that were generated. And that's how we actually did it. We shipped off piles of like 500 cubic yards a shot. That was essentially a waste pile.
Thanks.
Okay, there are no more remaining questions coming in online or by phone. I think we're ready to continue on with our speakers. Michelle?
Okay, thanks, Elaine. And we have another presentation that's going to be given by Paul Perrenard from EPA Region 8. Paul started his career with EPA in 1985 as a RCRA enforcement officer in EPA Region 4, which is in Atlanta. He then transferred to Region 4's Emergency Response Program in 1990 as an on-scene coordinator. Since 98, he's been an OSC in EPA Region 8 and has played a significant role in emergency responses at nationally recognized sites. Paul is also a lead instructor for CERCLA Education Center, which offers OSCs, RPMs, site assessment managers, and other environmental professionals training courses on the many aspects of the Superfund program. Paul also instructs various training courses, including OSC 201, removal process, waste treatment, transportation, and disposal, and knowing and using the NCP. So, Paul, if you're ready, we're ready for you.
You bet. Plus, I haven't been arrested since, like, 1992, and I stopped beating my wife almost a month ago. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Poudre River site, which is up at, starting on slide B1 in Fort Collins, Colorado. It's on the Front Range out here, about 20 miles south of the Wyoming border, nice little college town, Larimer County. Anyway, you're looking at a shot of the river in wintertime with a fellow standing basically in the stream bed. It's a river varies pretty significantly. In wintertime, flows will be about 20 cubic feet per second. If you go to the next slide, B2, this is sort of a late summer, which is past the peak flow. You'll hit 500 CFS in springtime, and then it'll drop to, say, 100 CFS, which is probably about what's running here in slide B2 in late summer. So, you know, fed by spring snow melt for most of the flows. Pretty nice little area. If you go to slide B3, it's sort of a – click the button, Paul. Horrible slide, but there's some features I want to talk to you about. The river runs on the – sort of the right one-third of this picture. If you look just above that, you'll see there's like an open field. Those are actually soccer fields that the city of Fort Collins has. They run youth leagues there through the summertime. There's a building, which is a rec center, basketball, weights, all that sort of stuff. And the circle area right there, just down from that, is a playground, swing sets and the whole nine yards. There's a daycare center and the building that's down from that, and then the rest of the area is fairly light industrial. If you look across from that, there's a triangle, which we'll talk about a lot more, which is the outlines of an old coal gasification plant, and it's sort of a significant feature. Also know that the entire area underneath where the rec center and soccer fields are was a landfill. We'll get into some of that history. Slide B4 is just a little higher view, and the site is marked in yellow, and you can see the river, the Poudre River, running through the eastern portion of the site. And by the way, out west here, for those of you back east, rivers out here would probably be somewhere between a creek and a ditch back east. So they're, we're not talking about the Mississippi here, much, much smaller setup. If you go on to slide B5, our problem basically started, we'll get into some of this in just a second, but they had black gooey tar started bubbling up in the sediments of this river as it ran through the town of Fort Collins. If you go to B6, we just got some pictures of what I mean by that. This is, again, a wintertime picture. You can see the sheen coming up in between the ice, but kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies, right? Jed's out shooting up some crude, and it came bubbling up here. So, you know, B7's just more of the shots, and the flow, the amount of this stuff coming up would vary over season and sort of form. But if you go to B8 and 9, I just got pictures of the material coming up through the sediments. Some of them pretty large. You would then see sheens and everything moving down the course of the stretch of the river, all from the coal tar. So if you go to slide B10, any second now, we'll get into a little site history. So come on, B10 is actually just another picture. Go to slide B12. So what started here, this was sort of a project in our program in sort of a weird way. The city of Fort Collins got a brownfield grant. What they wanted to do was expand the recreation center that is built on top of this landfill. And they were worried about vapor intrusion, knowing that the landfill had some history to it. And they actually have some vapor mitigation going on in the current building. So they used some brownfield money to sort of do a targeted investigation looking for that and the effects on the indoor air quality. So if you go to B13, they pulled out a pretty nice operational history of the entire area. And the landfill I mentioned earlier, you know, operated for a little more than 60 years, was the main disposal dump for the town of Fort Collins for that period. And took about everything and anything that landfills did back in that day. The gasification plant that I mentioned operated for a relatively short period, about 23, 25 years, something like that. And, you know, it's classic coal gasification, took coal, did a distillation project, liquefied it, and made various grades of fuel oil. After 1927, it was then sold to a business that had basically a gasoline diesel fuel distribution center, and they operated out of there, and they put in a Phillips station and sold gasoline, and that's really been the use of that parcel across from the rec center for, you know, better of 70, 75 years now. Also, there was a machine shop. You know, I mentioned it was sort of a light industrial area, a fairly large one, would service a lot of farm equipment stuff that for the towns east of Fort Collins, you know, so everything and anything associated with that. And, you know, so as they put this together, if you go to side B14, you know, they found evidence. They found evidence of, you know, a plume associated with the gasoline operation. There was a BTEX and a MTEB plume. As it turned out, the gasoline station was under a leaking underground storage tank mitigation program. They also found out that they had some from the coal tar operation, a big PAH plume, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. And, you know, lo and behold, if you went to the southwest of the site, there were some chlorinated solvents emanating from the vicinity of the machine shop. And if you go to B15, you know, the fact was, yeah, nobody really cared about that. You know, it was all under a landfill. As far as they could tell, they weren't having significant, and this is again back 2001, 2002, they weren't seeing significant impacts either coming through the landfill. And they didn't think it was affecting the Poudre River. And they sort of morphed the investigation to look at that possibility. And if you go to about B16, this is where the brownfield project sort of got offline. This is the first time, and you know, nobody's quite sure if this had been going on and nobody noticed it, or it's actually possible that the contamination plume was just now reaching and daylighting in the river. But they discovered the black gooey stuff that we talked about coming up through the sediments. And so they took a stab at trying to figure out what was going on there, and figured out there was a lot of coal tar, a lot of material underneath there, and much more than the city was willing to take on or a brownfield program was willing to take on as that type of project. So in October 2003, the site was referred to the removal program, and I was assigned to figure out what was going on. So going to D17, you know, first thing we do these days is round up PRPs. Public service company, big power provider out here, Xcel Energy, for you folks in the Midwest. They provide 90% of the electricity in the state of Colorado. Well, they had bought the coal tar operation and were the successor company to that. The Schrader Oil Company was the property that was the outfit that was running the gasoline distribution business and owned the gas station there that was sort of contributing from the leaking underground storage tanks. What was interesting, and we'll get into this some in the investigations, the city of Fort Collins, which operated the landfill, we actually determined them not to be a viable or a responsible party because it didn't appear like any of the contamination that we were concerned about was actually coming from the landfill. So we found them to be a contiguous property owner as opposed to a liable PRP. I should take this time to back up. You know, I've mentioned some of the recreational uses of the property. On the other side from the recreational facilities is the Gustav Swanson Natural Area. And the city has been talking about for a long time developing a riverwalk corridor and sort of a trail system that follows the Poudre River through the site. So, you know, the city, whether they're a PRP or not, had a fairly big stake in what we are doing out here at this property. Anyway, going to B18, we'll get some pictures to show what we did here. Starting in the winter of 2003, we started some investigations in earnest. And given the flow regime, our sort of plan of action was to try to complete the investigations over the course of the winter, low flow conditions in the river itself, take the summer when the water levels were, you know, flowing high again, to figure out and put a design and a solution together with the idea that we would come back in the winter of 2004 and actually do the remediation work. So anyway, in terms of the investigation, we ended up damming up the river, piping the flow around, and we cut some exploratory trenches in the bottom of the river to try to see how it was actually entering the river corridor, and that turned out to be a fairly key piece of information. We did some soil gas, basically using the diffusion bag sampling and some other boring techniques, sort of in an iterative fashion. Matter of fact, we did a triad sampling program right up for this, where we use those sort of field techniques to guide the next part, which is where we put the borings and groundwater wells, basically over the course of the landfill, over on the Schrader property itself, where the former gasification plant was, and in along and on both sides of the river. So we did that, you know, in a reasonably expeditious fashion over the winter. And what we figured out was you had this function that the gasoline was actually mixing with coal tar. And by the way, so that it first started seeing the leaking gasoline tank in the early 1990s, and you actually, as you looked at the plume underneath, could see the point where the gasoline plume was entering and see the change in the chemical and physical nature of the gasoline. So the gasoline and diesel was basically accelerating the movement of the NAPL, the coal tar material. Basically, the NAPL, heavy, dense material, even mixed with the gasoline, so it's dropping down through the alluvial sediments to the bedrock surface and was moving along that interface of the alluvium and the sediments up until it got to a point about 400 feet from the river where all of a sudden the bedrock became fractured and it started then flowing through the fractures, and that was sort of how it was entering the river. I got some pictures just coming up. If you go to B20, this is this upshot of one of the trenches we had in the bottom of the river. You can certainly see the one plume of tar coming out on the side of the trench. What's harder to make out is all these areas on the sides of the trench that look wet are actually reasonably saturated with coal tar coming down. So if you go to B21, that's just a long shot of the trench. If you look in the background past the track hoe, you'll see the dam we actually put across the river. And this is just the, you know, we would cut the trench with the track hoe, dewater it, try to get down to that bedrock interface, and then we actually even drop some borings down into the river. B22 is just another shot of gooky stuff flowing through the river. So if you go to slide B23, what we figured out, that in the actual alluvial sediments of the river, they were fairly much saturated with coal tar over about a 300-foot stretch. And then if you went into the bedrock underneath the river, over about twice that length, all the fractures, especially the ones that were interconnected with the river sediments, had coal tar in there. And it went down pretty deep, say 20 feet below ground surface of the river bottom, down in the fractures. If you go on to slide B24, just put together a site conceptual model. Starting on the far left side, you'll see the that's where the coal gasification plant was. The orange is sort of the alluvial sediment, and the checked stuff is where you have coal tar, and you'll just see it dipping down beneath the landfill itself. It was pretty amazing. We actually didn't find any coal tar constituents in the landfill itself. You, by the way, you can see we've got the groundwater table in the blue line moving across there. Anyway, as the coal tar moves from left to right on your screen, there's a point where it definitely dips down, moves completely in a fracture flow regime, and then comes back up to the river bottom through the fractures. This was important to us for a couple things. If you look at this model, actually, for a second, go to slide B25. Just, I've got a bird's eye view of what the plume looks like. The green line is where stuff is, where you have contaminants in alluvial sediments, at least saturated alluvial sediments. The purple line is where you see the material outlined in bedrock, and basically anywhere where it starts to fan out about halfway through the picture is where it starts getting into the fractures underneath. And you can see that, again, the extended bedrock is much higher than what was in the sediments. And then the you can see it right in the river itself, where we circled in green, is where we actually saw the material, and I'll use the word saturated with coal tars there, although the extent of, we found material in the sediments over probably twice that length, just not to the degree it was in the middle circle there. So go to B26. We spent some time arguing about what to do with this. You know, the Xcel Energy was basically trying to initially take the position that, well, the stuff was going to naturally attenuate in spite of the fact that it was actually, you know, bubbling up in the river and actually got worse as we were out there, you know, more or less starting to look like a lava lamp. They wanted to argue that we could probably leave this stuff in place. City of Fort Collins started out being interested in us excavating everything from the river back to the coal gasification plant. And, you know, I, of course, looked at that and figured that would also mean excavating a landfill, which had no contaminants, down to a depth of about 14 feet. And as much as I like the use of heavy equipment and live for, you know, men and large pieces of iron doing my bidding, I couldn't stomach the notion of digging up 14 feet of basically uncontaminated material to get to a layer of contamination material. So we opted for a sort of contained kind of solution. We were going to come, I'll have a schematic showing this in just a second, put a sheet pile barrier with a water withdrawal system for hydraulic controls on the edge of the river to intercept the plume. Everything that was in the bedrock and sediments underneath the river, we would go ahead and excavate it. But we were going to leave the source material basically in place. Now, back at the gasification plant, we didn't find the mother load. It seems that the contaminants were fairly well distributed between the old plant and the river itself, so there wasn't much of a source area to excavate anyway. And then this, what this leaves is sort of a long-term management of the water treatment system, where you pump a treat to maintain the hydraulic controls, as well as occasionally tap off the NAPL that's collected behind the sheet pile barrier. So just the next picture, B27, schematic of that, you can see where we just, you know, we had the plume mapped out reasonably well, so the sheet pile extends past that, and that's how we are going to intercept that. Going on to slide B28, again, in this case, we had to build a much more substantial dam, so we ended up putting a temporary dam, and now we're building, in this picture, a keyed-in dam. So, you know, lots of guys standing around watching the concrete go in, but we actually had to key it in to manage the water we had moving through there. Over that keyway, if you go to B-29, it was basically a compacted earthen dam across the breadth of the river. If you look at B-30, we're installing the pumps that we're using. So we ended up having six, if you look at the pumps the man standing next to in the foreground, we ended up having six of those. We could pump upwards of 200 CFS, although we averaged around 50. It was sort of a wet winter that year. But basically, we're putting all the Poudre River into eventually what was three pipes, piped it about a quarter mile downstream and put it back into the river for the course of this removal action. If you go to B-31, this is just the side of us making a mess in the river. You can see the dam and the pumps in the background just below the railroad trestle, and we started driving trucks and hogging out the river. Going to slide B-32. Any second now. Going to slide B-32. Oh, come on. Sorry, guys, for some reason. There we go. B-32 is just another shot of us cutting the bank. Like I said, the landfill itself came right up to the edge of the river, and so we ended up having to cut it back some. We'll talk about that in restoration plans. If you look at B-33, that's just another shot from down at the other end looking down the river. And, you know, we've got the bulldozer just scraping that stuff up. And, again, it's hard to tell in this picture, but if you can see the sort of damp sediments, all this material was saturated with coal tar. And I haven't really talked about it, but we ended up having to build a water treatment system for the coal tar, basically had a sedimentation system followed by sock filters followed by carbon polishing, where we took all the sort of construction water from here and ran it through the water treatment system. During the course of the excavation, we probably shipped off, and then we sent off for fuel bending about 45,000 gallons of coal tar. And then we probably had another $150,000 150,000 gallons of coal tar water mixture that we treated through the carbon system. So going to slide B-34 is a picture of what was my most absolute favorite piece of equipment in the history of the universe. This is basically a chainsaw with a 30-foot chainsaw arm. And this is what we use to, you know, now that we've got the river excavated, to cut the trench that we put the sheet pile in. We didn't dry the sheet pile. We basically, you know, cut a 3-foot wide, 30-foot deep trench with this piece of equipment. It was like magic. And if you go to slide 35, you can see the sheet pile now placed down into the river. And so just for perspective, he's probably the bulldozer you see sitting there just to the right of the sheet pile. Ooh, he's probably about 3 feet below the native or natural surface of the old river bottom. You know, going to slide 36 and sort of the point of what we're talking about here. This was a, you know, fairly high interest area. You know, the city had plans for, you know, putting back the recreational uses. The state of Colorado was fairly concerned about, you know, the Poudre River actually in the upper reaches is on the list of wild and historic rivers, and has certainly been compromised through irrigation and urbanization of the Front Range. So there are a lot of folks seeing something more than just channelizing this river, and there's a pretty big opportunity to do that as part of this. So we came up with what we were trying to accomplish with the restoration, and the first thing was we wanted to make sure it kept the remedy in place and intact, that the sheet pile wall was in the hydraulic controls were going to be able to operate in an automated fashion. But we wanted them to be fairly unobtrusive. We didn't want them to be abundantly evident to, you know, the public at large or anybody actually using this river corridor. I'll digress here for a second and tell you that right now the city of Fort Collins is actually putting a kayak course right over the stretch of the river that we're just talking about here. We also you know, looking at the second bullet, needed to make sure that after all that excavation, that when we put the stream bed and bank back, they stayed there, and hopefully in an improved format. Instead of a sheer wall of landfill material, we would give something that was a lot more akin to what the river looked like back before town of Fort Collins existed. We had a big problem both with invasive weeds and species, Russian olive trees and things like that, which are sort of the bane of our existence out here in the West. We were hoping to take this opportunity to get rid of them, replace them with native flora to the extent we could. Also, there's a lot of concern about habitat, both for fish and migratory birds. We had to do a consult with the Natural Resource Trustees. The Fish and Wildlife Service came out and gave us some suggestions in terms of the habitat for the restoration. Anyway, for the habitat for the wildlife and birds in the area. And, of course, as I mentioned, we needed to make sure that folks could get on top of and through this area without impacting the remedy and, you know, sort of not have their experience dominated by the fact that this was a cleanup site. So if you look to slide 37, I mean, then how we decide to implement these things, our first goal was to hide and morphing with the second, stabilize the banks. So we actually designed a different bank structure than we originally found. The face of the bank when we showed up, like I said, was probably, you know, at the highest point, a 15 to 20 foot length that was littered with landfill material, overgrown with Russian olives. And we decided we would lay it back a little wider and build in some contours to that, and then put the hydraulic control system underneath those contours. It was very important, by the way. We ended up excavating then, if you look at the next bullet, all the river sediments and it down into the fractured bedrock underneath that. And so there was a real concern, you know, we just couldn't throw fill back in there and expect it to stay. So we had to pay attention to the size and the type of material we put back in place and had it compacted not only to accommodate stability, but to allow for water movement, both from groundwater coming into the rivers, as well as the sort of saturated sediment flow that happens underneath the river. We would like to put the stream back to its original elevations. Like I mentioned, the kayak course, this had been targeted for this kind of use off and on for some period of time because of the relief it had. So everybody wanted it back in about the same flow pattern as we left it. And to the last bullet, nobody was interested in this looking like a Corps of Engineers channel. They wanted, you know, we knew we had to sort of armor the banks and everything to keep them in place and to keep the stream bed from moving, but we needed to do that discreetly. Nobody wanted to see 3 foot riprap for a, you know, basically a 700 foot stretch of the river. So if you go to the next couple slides, but B38, this is just a sort of an interim shot. If you look to the left, we have placed the rock material that's going to go back in the stream bed, and you can see we've cut the right bank of the riverway. These boxes that are right in front of us, and you see the one that, you know, it's marked WRS3776, it's actually a manhole that goes down into where you can actually access the sheet pile wall itself, as well as the pump system. And so we have, you know, had seven of these boxes along the stretch of the river, and you can see them poking out there, as well as some piezometers and monitoring wells that went on both sides of the sheet pile wall so we could monitor whether it was working or not. So this is what it looked before we finished grading, and if you go to slide 39, come on, computer. Sorry, it's taking a while. All right, so if you look at slide 39, you can see we're pretty close to finish grade here, where we've got all the boxes sort of buried at grade, and then by the time you get the vegetation over, all you can really see is the flat surface of the hatchway, and we ended up cutting and redoing all the piezometers and wells so they became flush to the grade. Just another shot, you can see, and we needed to hide. If you look at the bank on the right side of the picture, the right side of the stream, we've got the riprap that we sort of embedded and had to key into the river rock bottom, and we're moving that and sort of compacting that in place to armor that. And the trick was at the end not to have that show. So if you look at slide 41, what we ended up doing was bringing in some of it, like if you see the little point that sticks out on the left side, you know, we would bring the earth in a little higher and bring the vegetation mat over that with some vining materials. Other places we planted willows and stuff that would come close and then grow over what happened over here. And we'll, I got some later pictures of that. But you can sort of see now both sides if we, as we've let water in, how this is moving through. So I got a question to come here. It says, I'm concerned about the applicability to other areas. What are some takeaway points for revegetating other areas with the same, within the same climatological zone as the case studies? So out west here, you know, we actually have like 7 more coal gasification plants that have similar impacts to rivers. And so in terms of species and use, you know, you end up having to combine a physical removal of the materials with something that's acceptable to the community that also protects the remedy itself. And it turns out that you have to pay a lot of attention to what you use for plantings. We'll talk about the plantings of native species in a second, so that they don't, you know, roots don't go out and impact your remedy, yet you get something that's, from an ecological standpoint, provides more value and habitat and is more acceptable to the other folks who are interested in the river. I mean, that was sort of our overarching issue here. So going to slide 42, like I said, we have this area was peppered with Russian olives and thistle and a few other invasive species. And the idea, we were supposed to take those out, be careful about the fill material we brought back in, that we didn't reintroduce invasive seeds and replace them with native river habitat material, which, you know, coyote willows was a big one, sedges and other native trees were sort of the driver there. And again, this is, if you go to slide 43, this is just a shot along the way looking at, you know, the bank before planting. We've got a rough grade cut in, and then the next shot just shows as we smooth it out, get the vegetation mats and start putting the trees and other materials in. You'll notice, by the way, that we actually have some old snags, and we saved a lot of the cuttings from the excavation, because it turned out the dead trees were fairly important from a habitat standpoint. You really see those in these pictures. Where we actually just drove and embedded those in. So if you go to slide 45, this is just another shot of the river coming through, and you will see that we've got the stream bank stabilization coming in because of the some of the sedges and stuff that have already taken there and brought over. And you can also see that it's hiding the riprap in the channel. So we're getting both sort of an aesthetic benefit and an ecological one, and it's keeping our remedy in place, and that's sort of the overlap that we're really shooting for here. Slide 46 is just another shot with more of the different species going in. I won't dwell at it. You'll see in that picture, by the way, that one of our hatchways is open. There's actually a guy down there working when this picture was taken. And you'll see that when it closes, it'll be flush mount. And if you go up there today, you can't really see those because of the overgrowth. 47 is just a later shot of the river in place. And you, again, as the water level comes up, you can see we sort of have mimicked the high water mark with where the riprap ends and ties into the actual native bank itself. 48 is just another shot that of the river coming through at a higher flow. So if you go to 49, I mentioned before we talked some about habitat for different species. We had, you know, 3 or 4 good examples of this that I would have had no idea about if we hadn't talked to the folks from Fish and Wildlife Service and a couple folks who do ecological restoration. First is that when we did the stream bank restoration, we had to sort of mimic the undercut that you have in a native river. As it turns out, fish can drown. They get tired if they're swimming in fast flow rivers, and they look for places that are quiescent and flow, and that's typically the undercut of banks. So we needed to sort of incorporate that into the bank design. I've got some pictures of that in a second. Obviously, we needed to make sure we brought in enough large trees if we wanted a quick return for roosting and populating and that sort of stuff. And I've already talked about the use of snags. The other thing that was important for the stream, for habitat, fish and everything else, we went back to we had to actually incorporate some large boulders actually into the stream bed itself. And again, that provided all sorts of habitat for a whole bunch of creatures. So I've got another question here. What are the best slopes for the stream bank stabilization? I have found using a 3-to-1 slope, and I have also been using an armored toe. The arming that I've used is riprap. Coconut fiber logs, how's your experience with this? So the 3-to-1, what we wanted to do here was actually vary the slope as you went across. So we actually had our slopes vary basically from 2.5-to-1 up to 4-to-1, and it actually varied along the rank because that apparently is what natural rivers do. We used we didn't use coconut maps. I forgot what our maps were made of, but it was something that was idealized for holding seeds for the willows, especially that drop off. They were actually fairly durable to work into the riprap itself. So anyway, 3-to-1 is probably the typical planting number, and we varied above and below that over the course of the restoration. So if you go to 50, I got a lot of more stream shots, but if you look at the left side of the picture, you'll see there's some flat rocks sticking out of the bed, and you'll see there's like a little gap underneath those. Those are the fish ledges that we were talking about. This is, you know, apparently the fish go and hang out there when they're tired of swimming. And so those were incorporated along both sides of the banks underneath there. You can see, again, some of the larger boulders that we placed, and we dropped a few more both along the banks and a couple down in the deeper pools that are underwater in the downside of this picture. All right, so going to 51. Just another shot. You can see, again, on the far side of this picture on the bank, those are the fish ledges with the large boulders incorporated in there. You can see we've got some larger trees that we worked around to save cottonwoods, real common out here. Hopefully some of the trees we put in will get that size in a few years. This is slide 52. It's just another shot with bigger trees and willows in there. You'll see we actually... And went and paid for some larger trees to go back in at the planting. So I've got a question here. I've tied a lot of my stream restoration efforts with Roskin geomorphological, approaches. Are the Roskin approaches still a viable alternative? Got to tell you, I've got no idea. I don't know what a Roskin geomorphological approach is. We did outsource this, most of the design for habitat to an ecological restoration company, and they probably know that better. We've got one more question. The upgrading original source area appears to be quite significant. What was the reason for not addressing this source with the pump and treat? Ah, good question, Elaine. We actually went over that as we went through this. And the problem was, so once you got down into the alluvium on top of the bedrock, you had basically a 3-foot layer varying, down to 1.5, sometimes 4 foot of this coal tar underneath the landfill. And any place that you decided to put in sort of a pump and treat got its own set of construction problems in terms of how you got to it. You know, how can you put this through the landfill? How would you pipe the water treatment system? How would you put in the controls? So we went back and forth with a couple of different remedy options where we did upgrading controls, we did, tried to do source control, and none of them, looking at the groundwater monitoring, seemed to work any faster than if we just started collecting and removing the material at the river. And this was a lot less costly and a lot less intrusive, and also allowed for the city to have sort of complete redevelopment access to their parcel of land. So I'm going to bomb through the rest of the slides and get to the rest of the questions here in a second. 53, more shots of habitat, fish ledges, larger trees coming back in. Talked about public access. If you go to slide 54, we talked about the varied slope that would allow folks to get down to what became a flat bank where there was basically a step up in the bank where there could be a walking path that the city wanted to incorporate. And instead of having everybody trample down across the entirety of our restoration, we tried to provide little trails for natural access. So if you look at slide 55, you can sort of see, we're in the middle of the restoration, And we had people walking down and across through the area as we're still trying to ensure growth. And so what we ended up doing was then taking that area and making a pathway, you know, coming in and putting a mulch path down along the tree corridor, and coming, making places where people could get to it so they just didn't come hopping down the bank. Slide 56 is a shot of us doing a walkway. You can just sort of see that natural path that came along the slope of the bank a little later on in the restoration. So moving to 57, access. I have to admit that this was a pretty fun activity. We had to actually run people off of the railroad track during the course because our dam was right here. Folks wanted, you know, we're using this train corridor as a railway. We actually did a New Year's Day plunge, by the way, that was also pretty fun. But folks will get on top of areas if they have access to it, and that certainly happened here. Slide 58, just a couple of other issues that came up that I think we handled fairly well as we went through the course of this project. Somebody asked in the first presentation about survivability. We actually spec'd out in the restoration plan, basically, depending on the type of species, you know, we had like an 80% survival rate for trees, 75% for sedges and grasses. For surface coverings, we would do an aerial plan and have that spec'd out what the survivability would be to deem it successful. All the plantings we warranted to meet survivability with the subcontractors for basically 3 years out. So the third bullet, we had a hard time with there was a little off-strain to this site where there was a beaver pond. And I guess the beavers found it much easier to come over and chaw down our plantings than it was to go get trees from elsewhere. And there were days that I went through thinking I was going to get my daughter some beaver pelts to decorate her walls. But we had to end up coming up with some other control mechanisms where we'd wire basically the first 6 to 8 foot of our plantings and paint them so that the beavers wouldn't come and chew down our plantings. When I say this was a problem, they ate about half of our first set of tree plantings, and it was a pretty big nut to swallow there. So if you have those types of things, even if they're not in your area, do look out for those other species. Noxious weeds was a huge issue for us, both in terms of what we brought in for fill, and because we basically denuded this stretch of the river prior to replanting, it was sort of ripe for reintroduction or reinvasion. So we had to come up with a plan for how we were going to address that ahead of time. Also, you know, you can look from the pictures that I had in here, you know, some of those are 2 and 3 years after sort of restoration was done, which we really wrapped up in fall of 2005. But you had to follow it a couple of years out. If you went up there today, the site's looking in good shape, but it needs to be monitored for success, and you need to make that sure you've got some way of addressing that. Slide 59 is just a picture of one of the beaver cuttings. Slide 60 is just sort of a shot of what the site looked like. This is a late fall shot taken last year. So the riprap's out, but because of the colors and stuff, it looks pretty darn nice. 61 is just another higher view slot, actually a little bit earlier on in the process. And I think that's all I got for slides. Yeah, I just got a couple more river shots in here. We can probably just go get to questions. Let's see. I got a question here. I observed some applications by the Corps of Engineers using Benway weirs to help direct the flow of streams and rivers. Do you consider this a good approach? We looked at one point in time, the city had approached us wanting us to radically change the stream contours, and the weirs were how we're going to have to do that. I got to tell you, I didn't like the idea. Fighting water is a hard thing, and so we were much more inclined to get back to what was sort of the natural or existing stream bed because we figured that was just a more stable course, even if we changed the banks. We did have to key in with subgradient some sort of keyway trenches where we would lay concrete in to tie in the bedrock for subsurface stability, but we didn't end up doing anything to alter the surface flow or putting in some sort of weir system there. Let's see. We got a comment here. Roskin is a great classification system, but often misused for restoration-based design. I got to tell you, I'm not smart enough to tell you either way on that. Next question. Have you had a problem with deer browse on the newly planted stream bank vegetation? If so, what were the measures? Answers, we had a little bit, but not as bad as the beavers. The city actually provided folks to sort of on a daily basis patrol and browse the area. And because of where it was in relation to the rest of the urban corridor, that probably wasn't as big a problem as it might have been elsewhere. Let's see. Next question. Have you had problems with flooding events during the restoration process? So we designed, in theory, from a stability standpoint, for a 500-year flood. By the way, this stretch of the river experienced a 500-year flood in, like, 1976, and it washed out a good bit of the landfill. So it's a pretty real concern. We did argue quite a bit if you had an event bigger than that, who would be responsible for long-term restoration, and came to a 500-year flood as a design basis, and that's what the PRPs are sort of on the hook for ensuring. Anything more than that, they are not. We have had high water events, higher than even normal winter flows last fall, and the site seemed to perform pretty well. But obviously, I'm going to digress here for a second. We also then had to do some LOMAR modeling for flood for the floodplain, and you know, their design basis for that was a 100-year and a 500-year flood, so we recalculated for both. Let's see. Next question. On your revegetation efforts, have you considered using soils from adjacent sites that contain native seed stock? Or do you think that soils from adjacent sites might contain too many invasives? We looked at adjacent sites. Almost all of the, and remember that this stretch of the river comes through the town of Fort Collins, so we had the problem that most of the adjacent sites where we might have borrow material was urbanized and did have problems contaminant-wise as well as species-wise. So we ended up buying, you know, going out and getting ag stock for fill based on the sort of ergonomics of the and size classification. So we didn't have any next door sites that used here. Let's see. I can't do anything about your live audio, so I think you got to talk to one of the moderators about that. Next question. I've had some success with planting within crevasses of the riprap. Have you tried revegetation within riprap crevasses? Have not. I mean, it didn't come up here in terms of actually filling in some sort of dip or tying that in. The closest we had to it was keying the riprap into these channels we had to do for bed stabilization. So I just don't know what that was, how to address that. Next question, what was the total cost of the restoration? You know, I should have put some cost figures in here. If you look at the cost from the time we did the investigation through completion of rock wall completion and construction, total costs on the order of $14 million here, about $2 million go to restoration and long-term O&M. And that $2 million includes basically a $500,000 30-year present worth calculation for the operation of the hydraulic control system. So, you know, a little less than 20% of our total costs were involved. And that, by the way, would include the physical stabilization of the banks and such. So the add-on costs by going for native species and everything, you know, are then a fraction of that, you know, 18% or so that the restoration cost in its entirety was. Let's see, next question. I'm involved with greenway restoration in an urban area. We have lots of problems with vandalism. Do you have any suggestions to minimize or prevent vandalism? So the answer is absolutely is a problem for us here. Everything from our water, you know, treatment buildings getting tagged to, you know, folks and, you know, vagrants and stuff trampling down the bushes. We got a use agreement from the city of Fort Collins where they actually guaranteed to provide police patrols and that sort of control. Because of the nature area, they also have a set of rangers that, at least during the daytime, keep up with the area and keep track of vandalism. But absolutely, if you're trying to do something like this, you need to account for it. Next one, again, questions were raised about whether restoration had benefits that merited the cost, and if so, was any valuation of any kind performed? So we didn't do an economic valuation of the total cost of project and restoration in terms of trying to do some sort of net worth economic value. We had a very fundamental problem in that if we just said we're going to rip this out, stick a wall in, and then put a rock channel back in, that we would have no public acceptability to the remedy, including the property owner, which was the city of Fort Collins. So it became a stopping point. If we were going to propose something like that, Fort Collins was going to object to the implementation of Rivety. And most of the local, there's the Friends of the Poudre River. We actually had folks from Ducks Unlimited and a couple other folks concerned with migratory species, very concerned about what we did here. So it was sort of a jumping off point for us. We thought we had to include the sort of ecological restoration in order to get acceptance of the remedy. And again, if you look at a lot of the restoration costs in terms of the grading and stability, we are going to have to incur those costs no matter what we did. So what the delta you're really looking at is the extra plantings for native species and some of those other concerns. And I got to tell you, I can't see how you would have a cost benefit that would tell you that this wasn't worth the effort. Let's see. Next question. We've used hydraulic stinger to plant willows in the voids between riprap. So there's pretty good input there from Walsh Engineering. Grant's, by the way, got some experience on this site here. So you have his contact information if you have more questions about that. Paul, how are you monitoring, let's see, the coal tar circumventing the containment wall? Good question. So I mentioned as we were putting in the shear wall, we had both a set of piezometers and monitoring wells. So basically from the ends of the wing walls of the shear pile, we have monitoring wells 2 foot, I think it's 6 foot and 12 foot out, basically looking for that movement, as well as monitoring on both sides of the wall itself in the course of it. Plus we have little, they're not really sight gauges, but tubes that go down into the area where you expect the coal tar to accumulate, that you can go down and monitor to see how much coal tar is actually doing, how much coal tar is accumulating behind there. And by the way, we've actually tried that under different hydraulic control regimes. Right now, we actually have the hydraulic controls shut off, and we've had them shut off for 9 months now, to see if just the physical barrier, if that changes the performance of the wall and what accumulates behind there. So you can look through, play with ideas such as pulse removal, pulse hydraulic controls to actually just pump down after you have accumulation is perhaps a more feasible operation review. Next question, was a feasibility study prepared for the site? Is it available for view? So the answer is no. We did this as a straight removal. One of the ways we talked the PRPs into doing this was to do this as a removal action. They had commented that their coal tar sites that were on the MPL ended up costing them about 5 times more than what this cost them. We did do a something akin to an engineering cost analysis, an ECA. We didn't call it that, but we did an alternatives analysis. It is available in the site file where we looked at the different remedy options. Did a cost comparison, and then had a follow-up memo where we selected the memo. So we don't have a feasibility study, but we have something that's probably akin to that. All right, feasibility study. Next one, we have had lots of success with local bicycle clubs controlling vandalism along the distorted stream banks, and we've designed paved trails along the banks that are patrolled by cyclists. The only problem is the interface with cyclists and pedestrians. We're not sure how to deal with these interfaces. Any suggestions? So it's a good point. We actually, and I mentioned the Friends of the Poudre, that's a local environmental club who does some sort of informal monitoring along there. There is a bike path, not along the stream bed, but along the recreational corridor by the soccer fields. I haven't contacted them in the cycling clubs or anybody like that, but I imagine if you contacted the city of Fort Collins, they sort of have that informal network to help them monitor what's going on there. Next one's an audio thing, so I guess you got that fixed. Anybody else have any questions about what we did here?
Paul, we just wanted to point out one question that was submitted online. I don't know if you got to it. It was, how did you deal with fish and other aquatic species during construction? Were they removed from the area before it was dewatered?
So the answer is no. As we started laying the dam in, we ended up it phased in so that you had a gradual loss of water over the work area. And then so once we got the front dam in and then it drained out naturally, hopefully the fish are smart enough to swim out with the water, you know, we put a downstream dam in there to keep that dry and to keep the water from coming back up to the job site. We put some screens on the pumps. There was sort of a natural pit. If you remember the picture where the kids were jumping in, there was a deeper part of the stream right there where we basically did the water withdrawal. So then it was a matter of protecting the inlets from the pumps so we didn't suck fish up and in through the pumps and screen that. There was, by the way, the swimming hole itself stayed full of carp about the whole time. You actually could go down there and catch them in the wintertime if you were so inclined. Not quite noodling, but anyway, it was sort of a fun thing to do on the side. So we didn't see any sort of evidence of fish gills. We didn't see them, you know, line up on the stream bank. So I think from that standpoint, it was an issue that we didn't really have to address head on, but it didn't seem to come up for us. All right, sorry about missing that one, guys.
No problem. If there aren't any more questions online, anyone who's sitting on the phones, you're welcome to unmute your phone lines and ask questions to Paul directly. You can unmute by pressing #6, and I'd welcome those questions now. Well, it looks like we don't have any more questions coming in on the phone line. For those of you who are just kind of tuning into us now, we're currently on slide B63, which is our final wrap-up slide. We've basically gone through all the materials. I'd like to thank everyone who participated today.
Is it too late for a question?
No, sure. Go right ahead.
What would be the cleanup goals or cleanup levels for the groundwater for the monitoring? Any ecological aspects to it or just human health?
Yeah, so basically we had to come up with sort of two long-term monitoring sets. By the way, we did not actually set cleanup numbers or criteria for the stream bed excavation. Basically, it was sort of look for black goo and dig that out. We went through with a series of attempts at trying to figure out what an acceptable number would be from an aquatic standpoint, and you know the variance, the error bars and folks' suggested levels, you know, made it somewhat of a silly exercise. So what we then looked to was the aquatic stream standards for the water itself, calculated the set of discharge criteria based on those for the collected groundwater. Since we didn't think we were, you know, we're not really doing a groundwater removal per se, we didn't set up target cleanup numbers for what we want to remove the groundwater to, just for, you know, basically that we have control of the coal tar that was migrating toward the river and that either the seepage through or from the discharge of the water treatment didn't adversely affect water quality. You know, it's sort of the classic, do the MnQ-10 calculation based on our contaminants of concern. We have sort of left open-ended the question about when do you get to call this done, both in terms of, instead of trying to come up with a numerical goal, which nobody could agree to, we left it open for, well, we'll come back and revisit it with actual numbers and real field conditions. You know, we have basically a review cycle built into the operation plan where we, you know, they submit updates on a biannual basis, semi-annual basis. And then there's we put in, just stealing it from the remedial program, a 5-year review period after that where we would sort of assess what to do next.
Thanks. If there are any other questions, feel free to speak up now. Okay. Again, I'd like to continue and just thank all of our speakers today, as well as Michelle for helping to moderate. I'd like to thank everyone who stayed with us on both their computers as well as their telephones to join us for today's session. And again, on B-slide number B63, you'll find a link to additional resources. If you click and follow that hyperlink, it'll actually bring you to a summary or wrap-up page for today's seminar that has links to additional documents and resources relevant to what we talked about today. You'll be able to download the seminar materials, as well as provide feedback through our feedback form. And again, just a reminder to everyone, if you're looking for confirmation of your training today, when you complete the feedback form, you'll be brought to a screen which shows your name, the name of today's seminar, as well as the date and time in the computer from which you completed it. And you'll be able to print that for your own records. So I'd like to thank everyone and hope you have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.